them arranged themselves on a piece of furniture that could only be described as a rustic sectional, Hector and Claire together on the long side, Ella on the short side with Nellie on her lap, and watched a movie on video, The English Patient, Claire's choice. "He wouldn't see it with me in the theater," she said, pursing her lips, curling a sidelong look at Hector, not quite a pout. He spread his hands.
"I had a gig."
"You had a night off every week."
"I had to catch up on my sleep, right? Anyway, you saw it with Heather."
She threaded her arm comfortably around his elbow. "Not the same thing as seeing it with your boyfriend." Ella turned away to watch the opening credits. Juliette Binoche in the field hospital, or whatever it was, wounded men pouring in, shell fire. She'd seen the movie last year at the Ziegfeld with Joni, right before Joni left for Paris. Patrick was away on business, and while Joni had loved it, loved Rafe Fiennes and his tiger moth, or whatever it was, loved Kristen Scott Thomas and her upper-class beauty, loved the whole vintage star-crossed lovers thing, the film had left Ella unsettled, disconnected. Maybe because she still thought of herself as a bit of a newlywed. Maybe because Patrick was away. She wanted Kristen Scott Thomas to remain true to her husband, even if he was a dud. She wanted Rafe Fiennes to, well, she wasn't sure, resist temptation or something. Not to steal another man's wife. She wanted the marriage to endure. She wanted that vow to remain sacred. Now, of course, things were different. And maybe the movie would feel different, too. Maybe it was the kind of movie that meant one thing when you were happily married and something else when you were not. Either way, she didn't have much chance to find out because Claire was a movie talker, had something to say about Juliette Binoche's hair, had something to say about the green of Kristen Scott Thomas's eyes. Nellie fell thoroughly asleep in Ella's lap, not even twitching. And Ella stroked the dog's ears while her own right leg went numb under the dead weight pressing against some nerve or another.
"Hey."
Hector reached behind Claire to tap her shoulder.
"She's not bothering you, is she?"
For a moment, Ella thought he meant Claire. "Oh, no, I'm used to it," she replied, thinking of Joni, who also had plenty to say about whatever was on the screen.
"Okay, but you can kick her off if you want. She's not really supposed to be on the sofa."
"Oh, come on," Claire said. "You let her on the sofa all the time." Hector didn't reply, just gave Ella a sheepish look and returned his attention to the screen before them. And Ella went on, stroking Nellie's ears while the dog snored and drooled into her pajamas. At one point, Hector silently handed her another slice of pizza, refilled her wine. Claire refused both. Alcohol was bad for the skin, she said, and reached for the tube of Neutrogena hand cream on the coffee table next to the pizza box. When the movie was finished, Ella had risen and stretched and said she'd better head back downstairs and get some sleep. "Thanks so much for the pizza." Left them lounging on the cushions, talking about the movie, which Claire adored. "Great to meet you, Ella," Claire called cheerfully in the voice of a girlfriend who knows she has nothing to fear. And she really did have nothing to fear, because Hector was full of banter but never once made a pass of any kind, even the ambiguous kind that you could take up or ignore at your pleasure. Last night, for example, he'd called her cell phone and asked if she would come up and hear something he'd just written. She'd listened in awe, drank a little bourbon, laughed, and took over the piano while he played trumpet. At one point, he stopped and asked, without warning, whether she'd talked to her husband yet. She said no. She wasn't ready. "You gotta talk sometime, Sherlock," he said. "Can't put a thing like that off forever." then put the trumpet back to his mouth and played some more. Something slow and midnight, while a bit of moon slipped around the edge of the window to touch the points of his face. She'd slipped back downstairs a half hour later, warm and happy, conscience clear, not so much as a peck on the cheek, just a nod from the blue shadows near the piano, and a reminder, the one he always made, to let him know if she needed anything. Well, now she needed something. She needed a new damn kitchen and someone to remove the ruined carpeting in the living room. Which Hector was doing, right now, as a matter of fact, exhibiting the kind of enthusiastic male relish for destruction that reminded her of her brothers and their Lego sets. Breaks my heart when they cover up floorboards like this with cheap, ugly-ass polyfiber, he said, tossing another section in the hallway, whipping out the X-Acto knife for another barbaric slice. Seriously, you don't have to do this, Ella said. Actually, I do. He straightened and winked, grinned like a lightning bolt. Pays the rent. It's not carpentry, though. Close enough. Anyway, I like the company. Ella's cheeks were already warm from the grin. She looked down at the spreadsheets before her. She'd printed them out hastily before she dashed home and said, "So, what's the landlord like? Typical greedy bastard?" "Not too bad. To be honest, he's my dad."
"What?"
"Yeah, I know, right? Nepotism's the way to go in this town. How else could I afford the entire top floor to myself?"
"Because you're an awesome carpenter?"
"Nice try. It's a sweetheart deal. There's no getting around it. But I put in all the renovation work myself. It was just storage before. A couple of narrow rooms. No plumbing."
He gripped the edge of the carpet section in his hand and started to rip.
"Truth is, I could probably afford market rent by now. I just like working with my dad."
"Wow. Did you sell some music or something?"
"Didn't I tell you? I'm scoring a movie."
"What?" she screeched for the second time.
"Seriously? I didn't tell you that."
"No, you didn't tell me that. Are you kidding me? That's amazing. What movie?"
"Oh, nothing you'd have heard of. An indie flick, but..."
His muscles flexed hard. He took in a breath.
"It's a pretty cool break. What I always wanted to do."
Ella stared at the twin columns of figures before her, representing underwriting revenues for 1995 and 1996, broken down by client. Municipalities up and down the eastern seaboard, even a few on the west coast, raising money for schools and parks and community centers and sewer systems and everything else. She had been a newlywed while those revenues were being earned. When those bonds were being issued, just back from the Amalfi Coast, hunting for a new apartment with Patrick, who was flush and cocky with his first bonus as a managing director. "That, Hector," she said, "is a bona fide spectacular dream."
"Well, you know, if you look at folks like me a century ago, you know, starving composers, we were writing operas. Or trying to, anyway. Look at Wagner. Listen to Wagner. It's like hearing a film score, parts of it. He was the original score composer. He revolutionized the whole game. He was all about fitting the music to the action, creating a drama out of music, harnessing the power of music to tell a story. Wagner, Verdi, Massenet, Puccini, they were rock stars, household names. And now, modern opera, I mean, the stuff being composed today, it's practically irrelevant. Have you heard of The Ghosts of Versailles? Of course you haven't. People go to movies instead. But the music still is essential.
Try watching a movie when the score's stripped out.
He straightened and shook his arms out, stretched his fingers to the ceiling outlined by the sunshine, and for an instant he was so beautiful, so full of promise that Ella forgot to breathe.
Actually, she said at last, I've seen the Ghosts of Versailles at the Met a few seasons ago.
Jesus, I love you.
But I see what you mean. It's an insider's critique of opera convention. It's an opera about opera. I mean, it's musically interesting. It's incredibly accomplished. It's clever and complicated, and the production was amazing. But as far as storytelling, as far as reaching deep and moving an audience, not just of music geeks, but of human beings.
Exactly.
She set down the spreadsheets and stood from the sofa.
Look at me. I'm being a total jerk, just sitting here while you do all the work. Let me help.
No need. It's my job.
She took off her suit jacket.
Music's your job. Your real job, and the sooner you get back to it...
Nah, I like ripping up carpet. It's cathartic. Sends me back to the piano like a mad beast.
Well, what if I want to rip carpet too? Go back to my stupid numbers like a mad beast.
He laughed.
Can't argue with that, Sherlock. Okay then, grab a corner.
Ella took the carpet in her hands, and it was heavier than she thought. Stiff and waterlogged, unwilling to separate itself from the floorboards below.
So, when did you decide you wanted to compose? Or what you wanted to compose?
I don't know. College, maybe? I guess I knew early on that I didn't just want to write songs, even though that's the bread and butter. I wanted to tell a whole story in notes. I wanted to...
Hector's entire body came to a stop mid-rip. Ella nearly tripped over the slackened carpet.
What's wrong? She asked.
He looked up.
Nothing.
But she was already leaning over the spot where he'd been looking, newly uncovered by the soggy carpet.
There's a floorboard loose, she said.
It happens. Hold on, I'll get a hammer.
He dropped the carpet back down over the board and went to the toolbox spread out on the kitchen counter. Ella knelt on the exposed floor, which was covered with carpet scuzz and smelt like sap, and stared at the ripple of wet carpet covering the loose board. Already, the water had loosened the stink of decades from the fibers. The apartment really needed airing, but the weather outside remained chilly and damp. The kind of stubborn, miserable March that just wouldn't end, and Ella hated the cold. She placed her palm on the wood next to her knee and wondered how long it had been covered like this. Whose feet had last trod those boards? Whether you could connect with a person from another age just by touching the dirt left by a long-ago shoe. Hector returned with the hammer and lifted the carpet. Ella craned her neck to see.
That's funny, she said. There's no nail or anything.
There wouldn't be. Nails aren't so good for feet.
Then what are you hammering?
She began, and then... Wait! Hector's arm was already raised. He startled and looked at her.
What's wrong?
I think there's something under there.
Sure there is. The ceiling in 3D.
No, seriously.
Something surged along Ella's nerves, stung the hair at the back of her neck. The way she sometimes felt, late at night or inside some borrowed office, when she was poring over figures and spotted an anomaly, a gap in the logic, a flaw in numbers that could not, without human assistance, deceive you. Something occupying what ought to be an empty space. She put her index finger in the crack between the loose floorboard and its firm neighbor, and as she did so, she thought that the whole thing didn't look right. The floorboard was much shorter than the others.
didn't fit flush. Wasn't right.
Oh, come on, Hector said. There's nothing there, all right? Can we get a move on? I have to take Nellie for her walk.
Just give me a second. Ella scooted closer to the board and wedged a few more fingernails in the crack. Now, her nerves were really singing. Her head almost sick with certainty. Like someone was yelling truth into her ear. Like someone had hooked a pair of electrodes to her neck. Give me that hammer.
I'm not going to give you my hammer. Do you even know how to use it?
Do I know how to use a hammer? So remember when you told me to call you on any of your sexist bullshit?
Hector frowned and handed her the hammer.
Just be careful, all right? Don't split the board in half.
I won't. Jeez.
She inserted the prongs into the crack, felt the instant give of the wood.
It's so loose. It's like someone did it on purpose. I'll bet it's a treasure.
No, a murder weapon. Okay, Sherlock, but before you get too worked up, remember that wood is an organic substance, expands and contracts. Holy crap, what are you doing?
Ella lifted the board away. It was only a foot long and stuck her hand in the cavity.
Oh, don't do that, Hector groaned.
Ella withdrew her hand, which now contained a small black enamel box decorated in delicate oriental motif, edged in tiny gold lace, as fresh and new as if it sat on the shelf of some Madison Avenue trinket shop. All the tingling in her nerves and her follicles swept down into the skin of her hand, where it met the box's surface.
"Treasure, me hearties," she said.
"Let me see that."
"Hold on, there's something inside."
"How do you know?"
"Because I can feel it. Duh."
She tucked the box in her left palm and opened the lid. The damp, smelly air seemed to gather up and sigh around her. Hector peered over her hand.
"Wow, some treasure."
"Shut up, it's cool. Think how old they are."
"You're excited about a box full of old buttons?"
"Don't diss my buttons. I'd have thought you, of all people, would see how amazingly awesome this is."
"Why me, of all people?"
"Because you're Hector."
She lifted out one of the buttons, the largest, made of some kind of brass.
"Isn't that a crest?"
"Sure, whatever. Look, can you put the pwitty wee buttons aside for a second and help me with this damn rug?"
"I thought you didn't need any help."
"I do if you're sitting on the carpet."
"Oh, sorry."
Ella stood up and stepped away. Her knees were all wet. She hadn't noticed.
"You know what? I think it's the Harvard school crest. Look, Veritas. Truth."
"You know it that well?"
"Patrick went to Harvard. He's got the crest everywhere. It's practically tattooed on his forehead."
"Ironic,"
said Hector.
"Also typical. Most people I've met from Harvard, it's the first fucking thing they tell you."
She laughed.
"Sometimes, if you don't ask, they get frustrated and try to slip it into conversation."
"When I was at school in Cambridge..." "Status markers. Look, are you going to carry that box around all day, or are you going to take out your anger on some helpless carpet?"
"I'm not angry."
"The devil you aren't. You're pissed as hell. You are one seething, bubbling cauldron of righteous rage, Ella Gilbert, and the sooner you break loose and sound your barbaric yawp, the better. Now grab hold."
"Carpet diem?"
"Exactly."
Ella closed the lid and set down the black enamel box on the kitchen counter.
"Ouch,"
she said, jerking her hand away.
"What happened?"
"Like something stung me."
"What? Let me see."
She rubbed the back of her hand.
"I'm fine. just startled me, that's all.
Ella, let me see it.
The sharp tone of his voice surprised her. He held out his hand, palm up, and the compulsion to touch him was so strong, Ella didn't bother to resist. She stepped forward and placed her hand in his. He drew it close to his face and ran his finger along the skin.
Here?
He said. Right in the middle, below the knuckles.
There's no mark.
She pulled her hand back. Like I told you, it's nothing, I'm fine. Probably just a nerve twitching or something.
You're sure?
Hector, you doofus, she said. Do you see any blood?
Smartass. All right, let's finish this job up so we can play a little music before the sun sets. Deal?
Ella picked up the X-Acto knife and flicked it open. Deal. The sun had long set by the time they finished playing and lay side by side on the floor of Hector's apartment, staring up at the skylight.
So, I feel kind of guilty about something, he said.
About what?
I shouldn't have said that stuff about your husband.
What stuff?
About his going to Harvard, and the irony thing. You know, veritas, meaning truth. Totally out of line.
Out of line how? I mean, you were right. Right about his lying, cheating ass. She poked him with her elbow.
Maybe, but it's not my place. That's between you and him. You're still married. You haven't even talked to a lawyer yet, have you?
No, Ella whispered.
So I shouldn't have said anything. I just... Well, it really pissed me off when you told me what happened. And sometimes I have a hard time keeping my righteousness on the inside, you know?
Understood. No worries. Didn't change my opinion, if that's what you're worried about. They weren't touching. Ella lay just close enough to sense the heat of his body without actually feeling it. Overhead, the rectangle of sky was clear and silvery with moonlight. She was drowsy and content, and still faintly electric, almost dizzy, having eaten an obscene amount of pasta and drunk a glass of red wine. She wondered what would happen if their fingers touched. And then she remembered Claire and lifted both hands to her chest and stuck them firmly together. She could still feel a slight echo of the sting she'd received in the kitchen. Pressed her thumb against the spot. So, I saw Patrick today, she said.
You did?
In the lobby, on my way in. We're supposed to have coffee tomorrow. Hector allowed a few seconds to pass before he replied.
You okay?
Sure. I'm fine. It wasn't as bad as I thought. He hadn't grown horns or anything. Same old Patrick. She paused. He just really wanted to talk. Which is fair. I think I'm ready.
Good. That's good. You two need to start talking. Figure out where to go with this.
You know, I can almost hear your wheels creaking, trying to be fair. He laughed.
I just hate to see a friend unhappy, that's all.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that you're so cool about it. For some reason, it's easier to talk to you than my family.
What about your girlfriends?
She snorted. What girlfriends? I'm pretty much surrounded by men at work, and between work and husband, I guess I haven't really had much time for anything else lately. Just a few friends left over from college, and none of them live in the city. Plus the wives of Patrick's friends, I guess, but that's just superficial social stuff, you know? Making conversation over the 7-layer Super Bowl dip.
But you have a sister, right? What about her?
Joni? She's great. We love each other and all that, but we're kind of different. And she up and left for Paris a couple of years ago, and she's not good at email, so... There was another pause.
So what? You're saying I'm like the New York City girlfriend you've been missing all along?
Ella started laughing.
Oh my God, you are the best, you know that?
God, I don't know what you are. You're something else. I'm just glad you're there, that's all. I mean, glad you're here. It's just been really... Really...
Her giggles switched over into sobs.
Really sucky these past few weeks, you know? And... Shit, I'm sorry.
She was crying into his chest, and his arm was around her. She wasn't sure if she'd turned into him or he'd pulled her over. Maybe both.
And the only good thing...
Shh, just shut up, okay? Shut up and cry a little. You don't need to explain, I get it. I got your back, Sherlock.
So she let go. Let go and let him have it. All the tears, soaking up into his t-shirt. No words. Thank God, no fucking words. Just wet, salt tears.
When she was done, lay curled up at his side, head on shoulder, staring at the wall, Hector finally spoke.
So, you're staying the night, right?
What?
Jeez, Ella. Mind in the gutter again. I meant the sofa. No offense, but your apartment smells like the armpit of a wet sheep. Also, we had to shut off your water.
Oh. I guess that's a problem.
Plumber's coming tomorrow to get you hooked up again. But in the meantime, you're welcome to stay here. Or... just to pee and shower, if you don't think you can resist my smoking hot proximity all night. Your call.
Uh-huh. I think the question is whether you can resist mine.
Oh, Gilbert. I think we both know which one of us hasn't had sex in a month.
Ella rose to a sitting position.
Oh, Murray, you are so on.
In the end, Ella slept 7 hours straight on the sectional in Hector's living room, covered by a blanket that smelled exactly like him, and she woke up hearing his voice in her head, repeating those words, "I got your back," which had always struck her as a masculine promise, strictly man-to-man, until now. So... it wasn't until she slipped downstairs the next morning to dress for work... that she realized the black enamel box was missing from the kitchen counter.
Act 3. We get down to business. And how? New York City, February 1924. 1. Monday morning after my mama's funeral, I dress as usual and clatter down the IRT to the Wall Street station, in order to discover whether I'm still in possession of a desk and chair in the typing pool of Sterling Bates & Co. Naturally, on the morning of my departure for River Junction, I wired an explanatory telegram to the attention of Miss Atkins, and I sent a further wire, this one bordered in black, so as to give emphasis to my grief, on the actual evening of my mama's death. But Miss Atkins is the kind of woman who expects all family tragedies will be approved in advance, if you understand my meaning. And you don't ever want to disappoint Miss Atkins' expectations. Girls have a way of disappearing around here. So you might say that frozen February air lies a little loose in my lungs as I shuffle through the dark-coated 9 o'clock herd down the slope of Wall Street to the trio of bronze revolving doors cornering the stock exchange, each of them topped by inspiring scenes of battle carnage and boss relief. I enter beneath the siege of Troy and make for the elevators. Clackety-clack-clack go our heels on the vast marble floor. The smell of cigarettes surrounds us. Bronze doors slide open. Herd moves forward. Minute groans of frustration from those cut off. My palms are damp inside my gloves, blood all cool and light. The needle moves slowly, stopping at every damn floor, until we arrive at the 14th, really the 13th, as I remind myself daily. Then three of us file out, all women, dark coats and cloche hats, valuable hands sheathed in leather. Meet for the grist, and by the grist I mean Miss Atkins. Or perhaps I'm unfair. After all, her task can't be easy. Directress of a tapping pool smack in the center of downtown Manhattan. Our band of sisters, each one tappity-tapping away in hopes of better things, clothed in sheep dark suits and ambition of various straps, Black Stella, who sits to my right. Miss Stella DeLuca from Brooklyn, Crown Heights or someplace, dreams of sharing an elevator with a Sterling Bates partner, and the elevator breaks down, and there they are, stuck together for an enchanted hour while the engineers work to get the car moving. And 3 months later, she becomes the wife of a banker and takes a honeymoon tour through Italy and comes back pregnant to an estate on the north shore of Long Island, Oyster Bay or someplace, housekeepers and maids at her bidding, husband whisked by Packard limousine to Wall Street each day, garden parties and pony club and what have you. But in the meantime, she wants to enjoy herself. In the meantime, she's telling her parents she's taking a night secretarial course at Katie Gibbs, when in reality, she's stopping by the coffee shop ladies' room after work to put on coal and crimson lipstick and a sequin dress. And she's heading off to some joint or another for an evening of no good. Because why? Because life is short. Because the night is long. Because it doesn't even matter why anymore. A girl wants to have some fun. She should have some fun. She's got a right. And poor Miss Atkins has to keep all of us girls tapping and tappity-tap, air-free unison for 8 hours a day, plus a half-hour lunch break at noon. I don't know about you, but I couldn't do it. Anyway, Stella slides into place at my right-hand side at 1 minute past 9 o'clock, ripping off gloves and blowing her nose into a crumpled cotton handkerchief, and she whispers, "What gives with you, Kelly? Somebody told me she heard you been in the slammer." "My mama died," I whisper back, and Stella mumbles a stunned apologia of condolence, heaped high with exculpation, cut short by the arrival of Miss Atkins in the doorway of the topping room. Plump, oval-cheeked, wearing a navy blue suit, and an expression of what you might call profound maternal concern, if your mother were Catherine the Great. Stella stuffs her handkerchief in her jacket pocket and snatches a sheet of clean white paper, rolling, rolling, rolling around the cylinder. Now, here's how it works in the underwriting department at Sterling Bates. Those crafty bankers, they convince some poor unsuspecting business that it needs capital, lots of capital, the kind of capital that can only be raised by an appeal to the public financial markets. And the business agrees, God knows why, too many gin martinis maybe, too many slick bankers using too many big words, and the next thing you know, the lawyers jump in and build a regular Swiss Alps of paperwork that needs to be typed up on the double, in triplicate. And that's where we come in, we girls of the tapping pool. We arrive at our desks by 9 o'clock sharp, by which time some poor sucker, maybe even Miss Atkins, for all I know she sleeps here, has laid a fresh, stinking new pile of underwriting documents with handwritten annotations to the left of the typewriter, ready for transfiguration into neat, evenly spaced sentences an investor might actually be persuaded to believe he understands, which are then laid to the right of the typewriter. All very simple. And this particular Monday morning, I have arrived at my desk a whole 7 minutes before 9 o'clock, fresh-faced and suit-pressed in order to create the impression that I am ready, nay, eager, to recommence the transfiguration of whatever documents the underwriting department has cooked up in my absence, only to discover, I'm afraid, that the patch of desk to the left of my typewriter is empty. Nothing to transfigure. Nothing to do but sit rigid and conspicuously idle in my chair, typewriting paper wound around typewriter cylinder, hands poised, thumbs pressed together. While Miss Atkins surveys the room, I slid it keenly behind her round, black-framed eyeglasses and starts down the aisle toward me. "Good morning, Miss Atkins," I say when she arrives. Good morning, Miss Kelly. Will you please have the goodness to follow me? The question's rhetorical. All Miss Atkins' questions are rhetorical. She doesn't even bother with the formalities of punctuation, lifting up the tail end of the sentence. Just turns away and marches back up the aisle, expecting me to follow. And for the barest tick of a half second, I imagine myself telling her, as a matter of fact and to my deep regret, I don't have that kind of goodness this morning. Fresh out of goodness. So sorry, Miss Atkins. Instead, I leap from my chair, bang my knee against the corner of the desk, and hobble after her, because I've got another job here at Sterling Bates this morning. Another job that's got nothing to do with typing. And I had better find a way to stick around until lunchtime, or there'll be the devil to pay. The kind of devil that don't take checks. 2. Strictly speaking, I stand a good half-foot taller than Miss Atkins, an advantage magnified by the 2 additional inches of height contained in my square-heeled leather shoes. No matter. She's got a way of looking down at you when she's really looking up, craning her lace-colored neck to sort of stare at you severely into your place, until you find yourself shrinking, shrinking, like some sweet little English girl who's just swallowed herself the wrong kind of mushroom. Even me, Ginger Kelly, who never ate the shrinking kind of mushroom in her life. And even though I'm following her just now, through the doorway of the typing room, traced by the electrified gazes of my fellow galley slaves, down the long corridor that runs the length of the 14th floor to the rarefied offices on the south side of the building, from which the underwriting partners peer out comfortably over New York Harbor, and the gray-green lady who keeps watch over the shipping. I still have the strangest feeling that she's staring me down again, taking the measure of me, cutting me down to size right through the straight silver-brown threads covering the back of her head, which are gathered in the customary knot at the nape of her neck. She marches swiftly, little alligator legs churning up the carpet, makes a sharp left turn, and then a right one, opens up some door that guards not an office, but a staircase, cold and dark, and I clutch my pocketbook to my ribs, not a chance I've left that valuable object at my desk, and climb those stairs right after her, 2 flights up, back out another door, and to the left. And now, when she opens a door and holds it back for me to enter first, she does fasten me with a stare, all right, but not to shrivel me. Just a blank, careful gaze, entirely without judgment. I sidle right past that gaze and into the room. A lean, middle-aged man looks up from a desk and says, "Is this the girl?" Behind me, Miss Atkins says, "Yes, sir, Miss Kelly." He lays down a pen next to a leather blotter and rises to his feet. "Thank you, Miss Atkins." Door closes click. The man rescues a pair of small, round spectacles from the bridge of his nose and gestures to an armchair, the kind of cushiony leather-swathed goods you ordinarily reserve for your more prosperous banking clients. The office is large and set on a fortuitous southeast corner, allowing you to keep your beady eye on not only Lady Liberty, but most of Brooklyn as well. And yet, for all its generous dimensions and expansive view, the whole place strikes me as Spartan. The man himself strikes me as Spartan. Decorations spare and simple. Clothing hung from a gaunt frame. A palette that spans the rainbow from dove gray to charcoal. "Good morning, Miss Kelly. I appreciate your attending me so early." I take my seat, fix my pocketbook to my lap. "It's my pleasure, Mr.—" There is an instant of confused hesitation. I beg your pardon," he stammers. "You are Miss Kelly." "I am. Tapping Pool, underwriting department." The set of his cheekbones eases a fraction. "As I thought. And I do apologize for my recent absence. As I explained in my telegram to Miss Atkins, my mother was taken sick, and I'm afraid she expired altogether soon after." "Yes, I heard. Very sorry for your loss, but—"
"Are you really sorry for my loss?"
His head jerks. Those narrow, grayish eyes blink out some kind of Morse code. Han reaches for the pen, lifts it, sets it back down, knots together with the other hand atop the paper on the blotter, and then moves back to the damn pen like it's a talisman. Fountain pen, made of gold, probably cost a fortune.
I beg your pardon. I didn't mean... Naturally, you're heartbroken. Terrible thing. No doubt the two of you were close.
Not particularly, I'm afraid. But it was still an awful shock. The funeral took place Friday. If my absence has caused any inconvenience...
Your absence?
From my desk last week.
Oh, think nothing of that, Miss Kelly. Naturally, a daughter must attend her family at such a dreadful time. Her devoted family. The bank is quite understanding of such matters, I assure you.
I observed the fiddling of his fingers around the pen. How awfully comforting.
You need harbor no concerns on that account, Miss Kelly. Your position at the bank is perfectly safe.
He leans forward and fixes me with an earnest gaze.
Perfectly safe.
You know, it's terribly quiet inside this office. I suppose that's what prestige buys you in this buzzin', rackety metropolis. A sweet absence of sound. A vibration, even. Such that you can hang suspended over the tip of Manhattan Island and lock eyes with a saucy Appalachian redhead, and not a single note will interrupt your private communion with her. Not a word. Not a clickety-clack patter of a typewriter. Not the guttural roar of an automobile engine. Not the clang of a streetcar bell, or the rattle of an L train, or a siren, or a scream, or any damn thing. Just you and her, conversing in a silent tongue, until illumination dawns between you. And the girl, she leans back in her chair and crosses her promising long legs and smooths the pleats of her navy skirt that covers those legs, and she says, to your profound gratitude, because God knows you don't want to have to spell the whole thing out for her, word by word, in the vulgar language of commerce. I'm relieved to hear it, Mr. Smith. I am speaking to Mr. Smith, am I not? He closes his eyes briefly.
Yes, Miss Kelly.
I believe I have a parcel for you, Mr. Smith.
Yes, I am given to understand you might have a parcel for me.
He coughs. I smile.
Of course. I must beg from you some proof of authenticity before handing over a parcel like this. Do you have such a proof for me, Mr. Smith?
Mr. Smith nods and flips the pen vertical between his fingers, nib down, to write something on the topmost paper lying before him on the blotter, while an ocean liner emerges at that exact second from the corner of the window behind him, heading out toward the Narrows and to sea. Three stout funnels, steam flowing purposely from the first one. Mr. Smith sets down the pen, waves the paper in the air to dry the ink, folds it in half, rises from the chair. He's a tall man, as I said, and I am reminded of an insect as he rounds the corner of the desk and approaches my chair. Not your typical New York City bug, cockroaches and that kind of thing, overfed and scuttling, but an insect from back home. A daddy long legs or a praying mantis, made of sticks and sort of awkward about it. He holds out the note, and I part the sides. Read the single word written there in elegant block letters. Mr. Smith falls back to his desk and braces himself against the edge. His fingers strum the underside in an anxious arpeggio. Those long, fidgety fingers. I keep my gaze on the paper before me, my brow knitted thoughtfully, and while I can't see out the window, I imagine that ocean liner making her way across the broad plane of glass, crossing past the base of Lady Liberty, forcing her way through the skein of watercraft, doing business in the icy February harbor. At last, I lift my face and smile at Mr. Smith. I believe everything is in order. His shoulders slump. I think he even smiles. At last, I lift my face and smile at Mr. Smith. I believe everything is in order. His shoulders slump. I think he even smiles. I rip the note into a dozen dainty pieces, deposit the pieces on the oily brown corner of the desk, and open the clasp of my pocketbook. 3. I don't know what kind of message Duke gave him about me, but I'll swear he was scared out of his wits. Drink? I waggle the bottle over Anson's glass. Just water, he replies. Water? My goodness, I'm afraid you'll have to fetch that little old thing yourself. I set down the bottle and lift my glass. Cheers, then, to my seamless initiation into a life of bribery and corruption. He says nothing of that. I clink his empty glass there on the chest of drawers and swallow down my gin-like medicine. Tell me something, Anson. Are you teetotal by nature or on principle? Because it's illegal, do you mean? Have you ever had a drink, is what I mean.
I have.
When? The last time. Your last and final taste of intoxicating liquor. He glances out the window.
In January of 1920.
I see. You're the kind of fellow who likes to follow rules.
Laws, Miss Kelly. I follow laws.
An interesting distinction, I guess, though I feel obliged to point out, as I'm sure you're aware, that it's not forbidden to drink this marvelous ambrosia. I hold up the glass for his inspection. Just to sell and transport it.
I'm aware of that. I choose to abide by the spirit of the law, not its letter.
How admirable of you. I expect they can see the glimmer of your halo all the way over in Brooklyn.
He just looks at me.
He's standing next to the narrow, grimy window that overlooks the rear garden, such as it is, of Mrs. Washington's boarding house, the same window through which he recently gained entrance to my bedroom, in the manner of a lover, if not the spirit of one, his idea. I want it to meet at some joint or another, nice and smoky, plenty of sauce to settle my nerves. But Agent Anson is cautious of spies and eavesdroppers and wishes to keep our meetings as private as possible. So here we are, wedged rather intimately inside the four irregular walls of my bedroom, while the lamplight adds gold to his hair and underlines the strength of those barbaric cheekbones. I tip a little more gin into my tumbler and change the subject. So, what do you make of our Mr. Smith? I must say, he isn't what I expected.
Oh, what did you expect?
Someone seedier, I guess. Not a respectable praying mantis in a corner office.
A praying mantis?
I make a few long movements with my arms. Tall and skinny. Anson props one sturdy hip on the windowsill and fingers the long vertical edge of the window pane with great interest.
His real name is Benjamin Stone.
Benjamin Stone. Sounds familiar.
Should be. He's head of the Municipal Bond Department. Deals with all the city officials, not just in New York, but up and down the New England coast. Boston, Providence, New Haven. Structure bonds. Puts together syndicates. Connects municipalities with money. You might say he knows all the right people, if you're looking to transport a few quiet loads of merchandise past the noses of the men who ought to be watching for them.
And Ben's on the take.
Appears so.
I set down the empty glass. So arrest him. Anson lifts his head from his study of the window.
Now, what kind of good would that do you think?
Stop him in his tracks.
And your stepfather, Miss Kelly. What would happen to him? What might he do to you if he realizes you've double-crossed him?
He'd be arrested, too, for bribing a bank official. Anson regards me quietly for a beat or two and returns his attention to the window.
No proof. Only a fool would testify against him.
A fool like me.
Which is why I won't let you do it. This is just the beginning, Miss Kelly. Benjamin Stone, he's only a symptom, not the cause.
Duke Kelly has the entire New York City Prohibition Office in his thrall, to say nothing of the police in City Hall.
But I thought Mr. Shevlin was supposed to be incorruptible. Why, Izzy and Mo are in the papers every day, making arrests.
Sure, making arrests. Making arrests of people like you, Miss Kelly. People out having a drink, and maybe the owners of such establishments, and even a few men supplying those establishments. But that doesn't make a difference. Not a bean's worth of difference.
He sticks his thumb into the window pane.
8 million New Yorkers out there, Miss Kelly. 8 million New Yorkers, and at least half of them buying and drinking intoxicating liquors in public establishments and private homes. And that's a conservative estimate. And Messieurs Isidore Einstein and Mo Smith have arrested 1,000 or 2. And the New York papers call them heroes.
I consider the bottle of gin and my empty glass next to it, and I fall back a pace or two, away from immediate temptation, bringing me right up against the bed. I sit down and stretch my arms out behind me.
The thing is, you don't need to have the head of the bureau in your pocket, Anson continues. You don't want the head of the bureau. That's too obvious. What you want are the men who really run things.
Such as... Anson rises from the windowsill and steps to the bureau, the one I've just left. He leans his elbow on the corner and lifts the bottle of gin, inspects the label and the transparent curve of glass.
That's the point of this exercise, isn't it? We're going to let Duke Kelly lead us to each one of those men, until we've got what we need, until we've got enough evidence that we don't need anybody's testimony, until not even Kelly can wriggle free.
You sound like it's personal.
Maybe it is.
Those missing agents? He sets the bottle back on the bureau.
I should be going. Let me know when he makes contact with you again.
Now, wait a moment. Not so fast.
It's late, Miss Kelly. I imagine you have more agreeable appointments awaiting my departure.
Oh, you think so? You mean... gentlemen callers?
That's your business, not mine.
Say, you're not jealous, are you?
He fixes me with that gaze of his, all dark eyes and packed with silent contempt.
That's how he answers me. I push myself up from the bed and step close, real close, so I am staring at the blunt point of his oversized nose and absorbing all that contempt like so much challenge. As a matter of fact, I'm not expecting anyone tonight. Just you. I cleared my dance card.
Then I guess you ought to get some rest.
You're right. I ought. But I do have a little business remaining with you, Agent Anson, if you'll be so good as to oblige me.
I think we've covered everything thoroughly already.
Oh, it's nothing to do with the enforcement of laws. Heavens no! I've had it up to here with those for one night. Just a little curiosity, I believe, you might have the power of satisfying for me. Sort of. Well, returning the favor. I help you with your needs. You help me with mine. A custom we have out there in the country where I was bred up. Without his expression shifting so much as a hair, the contempt flattens into a thoroughly enjoyable wariness. I don't know how he does it, communicating such ideas without benefit of human expression. Or maybe it's all in my own head. Maybe I'm just imagining what he's thinking, and the genuine matter of his brain contains something else. Truth be told, those blue eyes are blank and relaxed, and his mouth set in the same straight line as ever. Might mean anything. I reach into the pocket of my skirt and draw out a button, which I hold near the corner of my right eye, not far from his own. Ever seen such a thing before?
A button. From time to time.
You big lug. I mean a button like this. A small crease appears in his forehead. He takes the button from me and tilts it toward the lamp.
There's a design on the face.
No fooling, Sherlock. I thought you might be able to tell me what it was.
Why me?
Because, to my untrained eye,
It looks like a crest of some kind, and I figure you'd have seen all the crests there are to see in this city. He turns his face to mine, and this time he really is frowning, no doubt about it.
Why would you say that?
Because you're a swell, Oliver Anson, all dressed up in your dour old prohy agent costume, of course. But you can't fool me. I know a gentleman when I see one. He turns the button between his fingers and examines each side.
How?
How what?
How do you know a gentleman when you see one?
Oh, a million things. The way he talks, the words he uses.
You've got a vocabulary, too.
I learned mine at school. With you, it comes natural. And your clothes, dull and all, but the material's fine. And the cut. I whistle. Why, the cut's sublime.
Where did you learn about men's clothing?
I work in the underwriting department of one of the most prestigious banks in the world, Mr. Anson, and I notice things.
He holds out the button. Yes, you do.
But you haven't said I'm right.
Nor will I.
I grasp the button in his fingers, but I don't pull away. I like the touch of his skin. I like the shape of his fingertips and the trim of his nails. I like the way his breath just touches the tip of my nose. And the button.
It's the Harvard crest.
Harvard? You mean the college?
Yes.
I take my hand away at last and rub the ridged brass design with my thumb. There's not a hint of tarnish. I reckon Mama kept them polished. A Harvard man, then, I say softly.
It appears so.
Don't you approve? Something against Harvard men?
I'm only feeling sympathy for poor Mr. Marshall.
Oh? And how do you know it's not Billy's button?
Because he attends Princeton University, if I'm not mistaken.
I slide the button back into my pocket. No, you're not mistaken. But the button doesn't belong to any lover of mine. My goodness, what do you take me for?
I don't take you for anything. It's not my business, Miss Kelly, to make any sort of judgment on your personal affairs.
And yet you just have. I guess I should be flattered. You must care a little for me in that case. He turns away.
Of course I care.
His voice is hoarse. The air goes quiet between us. That old Manhattan quiet, existing separately within the faint, constant cacophony of the house and the city around us. Somebody's gramophone playing jauntily upstairs. The tinny reek of jazz from Christopher's down below. The thumps and the creaks and the muffled laughter. And the arguments and the banging of stove lids. Hansen's cheek is bathed in light. His nose outlined in gold. And for the first time, I perceive that while his face has all the raw, prehistoric charm of a Viking skull, his ear is curiously tender. The kind of pink and elegant curve you want to trace with one finger while a hurricane rages outside. I found the button in a box on my mother's drawer chest, I say. The whole box just full of buttons. I think they might have belonged to my father.
To Mr. Kelly.
No, my real father, the man who sired me. Anson looks back at me, and for an instant, you wouldn't know he was the same man. His face is soft, his eyes gentle.
May I see the button again? He says.
I extract said button and hand it back. This time he gives the object his full attention, like a jeweler with a monocle right there under the lamp. I step in close, next to him before the bureau, and watch the movement of those thick, careful fingers beneath the light. Well?
It's the Harvard crest, all right. But I'm afraid it doesn't help much. There must be thousands of Harvard men in New York, and that's assuming your father's in New York.
He places the button on the wooden surface, where it wobbles and spins before us like a small brass top.
Do you have more buttons?
Yes, about a dozen.
Would you like me to examine them?
Not take hours.
I could take them home with me.
There's something about his voice, saying those words, not demonstrably different from any